Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 121, I'm joined by Drs. Daniel Chow and Will Park for a journal club discussing three recent articles. First, we discuss 27-gauge trocar fixation of intraocular lenses, next, bilateral intravitreal injections and endophthalmitis rates, and finally, a postdoc analysis from the DRCR-NET Protocol S study. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two retinal specialists for our journal club. First, in alphabetical order, from University of California, San Diego, waking up early on the West Coast, Dr. Daniel Chow. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here, Jay. And as they say, the early bird gets the start time in the OR.
Or in this case, a wonderful journal club with me.
But as a junior faculty, it's still not the case. I never get the start time. So, but I like to sing.
And from Minnesota, vitreoretinal surgery PA, Dr. Will Park, who's currently in Utah investigating how far he can take the Isom Park confusion. Will, thanks for being here.
That's absolutely right. And I'm excited to be on with Dan. I've never been on the podcast with Dan before, I don't think, so this will be fun.
No, we're mixing and matching a little bit. So we're going to cover three articles from the last. We're recording this now, August 1st, 2018. These are three articles that have been published within basically the last 4 to 6 weeks. Two of these were actually presented at ASRS a couple weeks ago. And the first one we're going to start with is, let's start with the surgical one. So this was published in Retina. It's entitled 27-gauge sutureless intrascleral fixation of intraocular lenses with haptic flanging, short-term clinical outcomes in a disinsertion force study. This is published with the primary author of Maxwell Stem, senior author Jeremy Wolf from the ARC group in Beaumont. Dan, do you want to take us just briefly through what they showed and tried to do in the study?
Yes. So this is some further research in their technique of scleral fixation IOL. I think this work started with some work that they had published, I think that George Williams had presented about using this scleral fixated IOL technique where the haptics are essentially externalized underneath the conjunctiva. And they've had, very good results with that, and that's been reported previously. And this is an extension of this study. Some differences is that I wasn't aware of is that it looks like people in their group, such as Jeremy Wolf, are using now 27-gauge to do this type of technique. And they wanted to look specifically at this idea of haptic flanging. And this term was a little bit confusing to me. It took me a while until I understood what they actually meant, because I'm like, what does that actually mean? What that means is they're just flaming the edge of the haptic with a low-temp cautery to make a little bulb so that it there's less likely a chance of it sliding out of the scleral tunnel. And so that's all this fancy thing is, basically creating a bulb with some heat. And, while this technique, while this flanging inherently makes sense in terms of as a way to prevent complications, is that really true? And is that hypothesis that if you flange it, there's a less likely chance of it coming out? And so they did actually a very nice study. They did first a study in cadaver eyes where they flanged the haptic and then tried to basically dislocate the IOL and kind of measure the force that was necessary to do that. And they found that indeed it actually took more force to dislocate the IOL with the flanged haptic compared to the unflanged haptic. And they also reviewed their clinical series of 52 patients who underwent this procedure with the flanged haptic, and generally they had, again, excellent results as one would expect from the technique. You know, the interesting thing I thought was the most common postoperative issue was actually intraocular pressure elevation, which I thought was kind of interesting because my experience with this technique is that a common complication I get is actually hypotony, usually because some of these sclerotomy are still like leaking or they're a little bit large. They do note that 4% of the patients needed a re-op. One was due to dislocation and one was due to hypotony. But I think overall it was a nice study to add to it. I think also to provide some laboratory evidence that this phalanging actually helps. And generally they had good results, and that this 27-gauge phalange technique seems like an excellent approach for scleral fixation of IOL without capsular support.
Well, you and I actually talked a little bit about the basis of the technique when we did one of our retinal physician series a few months back. I think Ali Khan wrote a review of different IOL techniques, and you kind of gave some pearls and tips for this. So, but let's talk a little bit about what the paper showed, maybe, you know, limitations, right? So obvious limitation, you know, small series for the cadaver eyes, was five eyes that they did it. But I mean, you're someone, when we've done Masterpiece Retina, we've done a couple of cadaver eye series, including like the Smitty Trocar series. Nice study design overall. Any big limitations outside of, you know, retrospective kind of case series for the data? Any big things you would want to caution before we get into discussion?
First off, you know that this is right in my wheelhouse, man. If I have a wheelhouse in retina, it is the cadaver eye surgical study. I love these things. It's a small number of eyes, but they did in each eye, they did one haptic each way. So that's reasonably consistent in that regard. I just think the cool study in that, I love these ways that you can kind of just look at the physics of it and kind of verify something that we all thought, or sometimes occasionally surprise us with findings. And that verifies what I think many people feel about the phalanging technique, that it probably gives you some security against internal migration of the haptic. You know, it's funny, at ASRS, I was talking to a former Beaumont fellow who does a lot of these, who doesn't flange them at all. And he feels that they are perfectly stable without that, and hasn't had any subsequent dislocations. And he's only been doing it for a year, of course, so who knows what the longer term outcomes will be. But it was interesting to hear that viewpoint from it. I've also become a little bit of a connoisseur of the flange or the bulb on the end. My procedure for that has changed a little bit. And just out of curiosity, Dan, do you use 25 gauge or 27?
I do use 25 gauge. So that was an interesting point, like to actually be able to do this with 27 gauge. I can see the advantages, because I still get, it's not uncommon for me to get actually hypotony after this procedure. And so I think, you know, potentially going to a 27 gauge, you know, may decrease the incidence of that.
Yeah.
Well, what's your sense?
So I did 25 at first, then I switched to 27, and it's been exactly what you said. I had one bulb that I made migrate internally intraoperatively in 25. Even though I made the bulb, I just saw the thing like slide right through. And so I had to pull it back out again and make the bulb bigger. The comment I'd make about the bulbs is at first I didn't do much of one, and then I made them too big. And then if you make them too big, it's kind of hard sometimes to stick them back through the conge at that point in the surgery, because they're hard to stick them back through, and then they stick up from the thing. So I actually make my, with 27 gauge, I make my bulbs relatively small. And so it's not much more than a second or two, and just a kind of slight widening of the edge of it. And I feel like that does the job for me. Now how mine would hold up to the cadaver eye study with the mechanical forces, I don't know. Maybe they wouldn't be quite as good as larger bulbs. But I do feel like they were noticing that dislocation was noted on in the vast majority of these eyes, if not all of them, in the first couple of days postoperatively. And so I do feel like the first hurdle you have to clear with this is making sure that your lens is well situated on day one or day two postoperatively. And that probably has a lot to do with just the orientation of your tunnels and whether you kinked a haptic or not when you put it in. But if you can get through that first few days with it centered, I think that it does very, very well, perhaps regardless of how big the bulb is. I don't know.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that, Will. I don't think the phalange actually is, again, the critical aspect of whether it will prevent dislocation. I agree with you. I think it's the orientation of your scleral tunnels and then how your haptics are sitting, because I know sometimes when we do these cases, like the length of the haptic that's under the conge may not be symmetric. Like maybe one wound, the haptic actually very little is poking out and the other one is a little bit more. And I think that's due to a little bit of a misalignment of the scleral tunnels. And then I think that's, a much more likely cause for dislocation. And I think that completely agrees with the clinical data that in the first couple of days, if it's not situated well, it may fall. But if it is situated well, regardless of whether you flange or not, it probably doesn't make a difference. I would say one practical comment about the flange is that you want to use the low temp cautery and not the high temp cautery. I remember when I was first doing it, I was like, oh, I vaguely remember we should cauterize it with something. So I was using the high temp cautery, and I was like, it was such a difficult time to get actually a good bulb without, you know, causing the eye to get too hot. And so now kind of looking back, so I would just recommend using the low temp cautery. Otherwise, you'll be a little bit discouraged and frustrated with your phalange creation.
You know, can I make one more brief comment here, Jay? Sorry to interrupt. The other kind of pearl from the study, which I started doing over the last year or so, because I got burned once on it, is reverse pupillary block and creating a neurotomy.
Yeah, and I was going to comment, Will and Dan, those are great pearls. I think that the interesting overall thing I've noticed, and IOL techniques, I guess, is a very good example of this, is what there's a lot of available, useful, peer-reviewed journal articles about the subject. But there's still no replacement for talking to someone who's done a lot of these or trained at an institution where they did a lot of these. And because a lot of times there's a lot of knowledge about or tips or pearls about how to do it that you aren't going to gain unless someone has gone through those missteps, and they may not be published or available out there. And I find this all the time when, you know, I'll do a complicated surgery, I'll planning one, I'll be like online, I'll be reading, and it just isn't. They're kind of complementary. You need to talk to somebody who's done a lot of these. And it's interesting you talked to a former Beaumont fellow. You know, I talked to a different Beaumont fellow, and he was like, yeah, I flange, but flanging only helps and he had done a lot of them at Beaumont and now in practice if it's 27 gauge. You know, for 25 gauge, the flange isn't really sufficient, doesn't really make a difference. Because I noticed what you noticed, Will, when I've only done a couple of these now, I've started trying to incorporate it. And I started 25 because the learning curve was supposed to be a little easier. The flange didn't prevent the haptic from going in when I did it the first time. And then I got a little worried because I was like, oh, it went that way. Is it going to come back out? And I was able to get it back out the tunnel. But the flange isn't going to prevent it. Pupillary block's a really good point. I've put a PI in the ones I've done. I don't think there's a disadvantage to creating a PI. And again, the other thing is, Will, when you and I discussed, I think Boza Todorovic had written a series about the original George Williams technique maybe a couple years ago, when it was part of that review. Vitreous hemorrhage was super common in that series. I think we had brought that up. It was like 30s percentage-wise. Yeah. And I asked you, and you were like, you know, I haven't really seen that. Here, vitreous hemorrhage was very uncommon. And I don't know if that's a difference in gauge or just a difference in experience that you're causing maybe less ciliary body trauma at the time of pulling the hemorrhage.
I think it's moving it posteriorly.
Right. Moving the tunnels posteriorly. The tunnels.
Yeah.
Where do you go with your tunnels right now?
So 2 to 2.5 back. And I know that a lot of people started off in the kind of 1.5 millimeter back range, maybe 1 millimeter back. And some people still do it that way and do fine with it. But I wonder whether that's the location of your tunnels.
It's, you know, so interesting because it's analogous to Gore-Tex, because I think the Gore-Tex technique was originally described as like 2 to 2.5. But by the time I was a fellow and they've been doing it for a couple of years, most people were doing it 3 back and they kind of moved further back. I'm not sure why it started anterior for both of them. My guess is I don't know if it was to be closer to where the sulcus was rather than the bag, but it seems like people have realized that if you go a little further back, you're more likely, less likely to cause bleeding in the ciliary body, maybe. But yeah, it's similar has happened with the Acrios technique. Dan, any final thoughts before we move forward?
I think I absolutely agree with your point that you can watch as many videos, read as many articles as you want, but talking to someone who's done the technique and has a lot of experience is really the best thing. And, you know, as these techniques originated, I think, at Beaumont. I think we've all had our favorite Beaumont fellow to talk to about this. And so, you know, at my institution, Eric Noodleman, who trained at Beaumont, has done a lot of these, and it's been really helpful to pick his brain about it. One critical thing that I realized when I was working with different fellows, and I didn't really realize it that this was such a critical thing, is when you decide to pull the trocar out. So if you're going in there with a forceps, you grab the tip of the haptic, then the question is, when do I slide the trocar up the forceps? And I found out through unfortunate experience is that it sounds like the time you should do it is after you grasp the haptic, but before you actually pull it out of the tunnel, is that you take out the you take out the trocar. And I think what that does is keeps the tunnel smaller and actually fixates the IOL. So I did some with one fellow where, you know, he had done that, and I think I didn't really notice that, and things went beautifully. I'm like, oh, this is an awesome technique. But then I was working with a different fellow, and I couldn't really remember that. I was like, oh, why not, it makes sense. Why don't you pull it out? Let's see the haptic before, like, past the trocar, and then pull the trocar over it. And that was a disaster, I think, for a number of reasons. One is that I think you have a much more likely chance of kinking the haptic when that happens. And I think it also, by going through the trocar, it actually widens the scleral tunnel that you're pulling it through, because you're kind of like, it takes a lot more effort to pull it through. So you have a wider tunnel, so it may not sit as well. You get more hypotony. So I think that was a learning. And I think it's mentioned in their technique here that it's a very subtle thing that one may not realize that's so important until you don't do it and you realize the difference. When do you guys pull your trocar?
Yeah, I mean, I've done less than both of you, I think. I think what I was told by my favorite Beaumont fellow was to do it right after I grasp it before I come out. So I'm very OCD about that in the handful I've done. So I haven't run into that problem, but again, I was pre-warned. And again, this is probably things they learned from experience and missteps when they were first doing it. Will, what about you?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that.
Perfect. Well, moving on to the next paper. This paper is actually from my alma mater at Mid-Atlantic Retina, Wills, entitled Endophthalmitis Rates After Bilateral Same-Day Intravitreal Anti-Vascular Endothelial Growth Factor Injections. Dorga Borkar, who's the second-year fellow, was the primary author. Jason Hsu was the senior author. I will just briefly describe this article, and then we can talk a little bit about what they did. So they essentially looked at the whole practice, looking back over about a 5.5 year period, to identify all patients who had bilateral injections on the same day. And they identified over 100,000 of these injections performed in about 50,000 office visits for nearly 6,000 patients. And most of these were for either AMD or DME. And they identified 28 cases of endophthalmitis with a rate of about 0.027%, and there were no cases of bilateral endophthalmitis. No patients had more than one occurrence, so no patients had endophthalmitis in multiple times that they were getting bilateral injections. And the conclusion, the take-home points they made were that the rate of endophthalmitis was similar for bilateral injections as it was for single-eye injections, as has been reported previously in the literature, and that bilateral injections, which are often much more efficient from a patient's standpoint, they have to come in multiple times, that it doesn't carry any increased risk of infection from what they saw. I think that I'll preface, but I think most practices are doing bilateral injections at this point. I think it's been done for a number of years, but it is nice to see data that supports that this is safe. Will, your preliminary thoughts on this paper and how you felt about the results?
My preliminary thought is that as much as it pains me to compliment something that comes from an institution affiliated with Jay Schrader, I think I have to.
Peripherally affiliated, formerly affiliated. You know, things were only on the up and up.
I feel a little better about it. I love these Will studies because this is something that I don't think any of us are surprised by, but it's something that it's really good to have published, and it just shows that in a huge number of people. We can feel like we're not doing any harm by doing bilateral injections. And the other nice thing about this study was that the injection protocol between the individual doctors wasn't perfectly consistent, but it was pretty darn consistent. And I think that made it a little easier to analyze the results. But I mean, I certainly wasn't surprised by this, and I'm really glad this is published, basically.
Dan, limitations of this study?
I think I agree with Will. I agree with Will on, I think it's an excellent study, and again, it needs to be published. Limitations, I mean, it's a single, you know, single center, though I think many different positions over a large area. You know, I don't think there's been any report of, like, kind of geographic differences in terms of endophthalmitis rates. Like, for instance, if you're in the Northeast, maybe things are a little bit cooler. You're not getting as much infection as opposed to hot Miami weather, but I don't think that actually bears out. You know, it's retrospective, but I think overall, like, for what it's supposed to do, it's pretty, it satisfies the bill. I don't have any major complaints. I do have one comment, though, and I'd like to chide the second year fellow who did the study, is that, you know, they weren't completely comprehensive in their literature review of previous case series of bilateral injection series. In fact, so I published one in 2014, expert opinion in drug delivery. This was with Nell Gregory, the chief of the VA at all three of our alma maters at Bascom Palmer, where we reviewed our bilateral injections at the VA, and we reported, you know, it was a small study. It wasn't 100,000, but it was, you know, 660 patients with bilateral injections. We had no incidence of endophthalmitis. So I was a little bit, you know, a little bit sad that wasn't included, but that's fine. I mean, but just a note that this could happen to you. Like, if I was reviewing this article, that might, you know, I still think it's an excellent paper. I would have accepted it, but just a funny thing to note. You know, one more, on a more serious note, you know, an interesting thing is, I think, the injection technique. And one thing that I thought was interesting was the topical anesthesia. I know, based on the survey, like, a lot of people, I think, in the community are using actually topical anesthesia. And, you know, though the studies show that there's no difference, say, between topical anesthesia versus subconj versus, you know, lidocaine, you know, I generally use actually subconj lidocaine because I feel like, you know, that decreases the number of complaints from patients. So that's an interesting thing. I'd be curious to hear in general, Jay at Wills, what was your experience in terms of the topical anesthesia and patient perception? The other thing is the bimanual lid retraction. So they don't use a lid speculum. And I'm kind of a little bit curious about that technique as well, because I think that could add a lot of comfort, and it's interesting. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. The other interesting thing was that they didn't change gloves or, like, kind of use different bottles between different eyes. They treated the eyes essentially the same. And this was different than what we did in Miami, where we kind of completely threw out the bottles and changed gloves. And so this is actually a good learning. I think that may not necessarily be necessary, even though I think it goes against the principles of, like, aseptic technique. And if you're doing bilateral surgery, you should really treat them as two separate surgical, like, procedures rather than a single procedure. But, you know, I think this is really good evidence that suggests that may not be necessary.
I would like to revise my comment. Yeah, any study that doesn't acknowledge Dan Chow's hard work, you know, is dead to me. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Major limitation. Yo, comments. There's a lot of meat on the bone there to pick at. So the first thing is, you're right. You know, you want to be comprehensive. But this was before Wills won the Doximity rankings for best residency, so they needed to throw a little bit of shade and a decreased Bascom's impact factor. They didn't put your particle in.
Jay, that's fake news, as Donald Trump would say.
Well, we won't get into politics.
Nothing
right
against
now.
Wills. In all good fun.
Not that this is a biased group, but I'm not even going to get into it. I get emails from both institutions voting, asking me to vote for them. I don't even know what to do. Second thing, the injection technique. So, yes, most of the physicians when I was there did topical only. And actually, the patients were fairly comfortable. I think patients, actually, I was surprised. You know, we had done mostly pledgets or some sort of lidocaine gel when we were residents. And, you know, topical alone was fine for most patients. I think that a lot of the differences in anesthesia vary based on patient expectation and regional preferences. And I think just I was talking to one of my friends who's out in California, and they're like, you know, they started practice a few months ago, or within the last month, and they were surprised. Like, everyone in the group does subconj lidocaine. And I was like, you know, that's because, you know, Californians are soft and people in Northeast are, like, hard and tough coal miners, steel
miners.
That's
right. That's right.
But it is expectation, right? I think that certain areas, like Ryan Isom told me, and he didn't use subconj lidocaine for his injections here, but when he became an attending at Utah in his practice, he switched over because that's what his partners were doing. That's what the expectation was. So, yes, most patients were very, very comfortable, and only one of the physicians exclusively uses a subconj lidocaine, at least from 2 years ago when I left. In terms of the prep, yeah, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you guys. They prepped both eyes essentially similarly, the same, and we saw the endophthalmitis mitis rate was not different here. We tend to be more conservative here at Bascom, where you know we kind of prep each eye individually, and it's a little more of a process to prep each eye. That being said, they do prep each eye, and you walk in the physician and here even and do injections on both eyes at the same time. It's not like you prep one eye, do it. It's like a surgical technique where you do everything and then do the other eye. And then the lid retraction, Alan Chang had published the retract study a couple of years ago with Hassan Rahimi and others. And that was essentially looking at comfort with lid retraction versus speculum in a bunch of patients at Wills. And they kind of did it prospectively. And patients were actually more comfortable with lid retraction. There were no safety concerns. As long as you kind of expose the lids and the lashes aren't in the field of the injection. I don't do that exclusively here at Wills. I did that exclusively. A lot of the attendings did that exclusively. Usually what happens is the assistant will just hold the lids. There were physicians, some talented physicians who were able to hold both lids with one hand while they inject with the other. I will do that though. If patients are having any difficulty with the speculum here, I'll do that. I probably do it in about a third of my patients where I just hold the lids. And I do think it's much more comfortable for the patients. I think for many patients who get injections over and over and over again, they are much, one of the things they look forward to the least is getting the lid speculum in. So I do think that retraction is nice. And you know, who knows, this would be a study that would be really difficult to do, but who knows if there are long-term effects we know from putting a speculum in someone's eye over and over again in terms of ptosis. This is the Ben Erickson section of the podcast, but I don't know what lid retraction would do long-term for that. It could be better or worse, but anyway, those are my thoughts on all the questions you asked.
Jay, one other comment. I think.
Go ahead.
I'll just make a quick comment. I think it's actually really, in this case, actually in some ways shrewd for Will to do this type of study. So you can imagine, I'm just thinking from like a medical legal standpoint, like for instance, say if a patient gets endophthalmitis and decides to bring up a lawsuit and it's a bilateral injection, and in this case, you know, you're prepping both eyes as the same, that could be a weakness for, say, an expert witness to go, well, that's actually not standard of care. That's not bad aseptic technique. You're treating the two eyes as the same. You shouldn't. But I think having this study showing that, well, we do that for 100,000 eyes and that there's no difference, then I think that's an excellent defense against that. So I think just from a practical standpoint, I think that's, again, as Will said, this is very useful to have in the literature for those that use this type of technique and can feel like, you know, that this, there's good evidence that suggests that this is standard of care and not lower than standard of care. In case they have any issues.
I got very excited earlier when you said that some talented physicians use one hand for the lids, which made me feel briefly like you were talking about me because I use one hand for the lids, but to be honest, it's really not that hard at all. So I think I'm talented for a lot of reasons, enough of that one. So holding lids with one hand is very doable, and I agree with everything else. The only thing, I was looking through the article right now, and I can't see, the one thing we certainly do, and I assume they do it there too, though, is if you're doing bilateral injections, specifically of Avastin, that you're using different lots for the two eyes. I didn't see that in the methodology.
I don't know. I assume that. I actually don't remember or don't know.
Maybe that's not as commonplace as I think it is, but I would certainly do it is use different lots of the medicines for both eyes, just so we don't.
I don't want to even, my lack of knowledge is going to hurt me here. I don't even know if we do that for sure here. I need to check the lot numbers. I know that we had the discussion in the past. I think that people have talked about this. I'm not sure we even do that for sure here.
No, maybe I'm atypical. Maybe that's not important. I always have done it.
Yeah. I think it's smart if you're getting a compounded medication.
Yeah, and I agree. I am guilty of not necessarily checking what lot I'm using. And I think that's a great point that I need to be more insistent about, using a different lot.
Well, I don't want to come on too strong on that. I certainly don't have any data to back that up. I don't want to make it seem like that's the right way to do it.
I think, not to focus so much on the medical legal aspect, but I think it is like an unfortunate reality is that I think if you're not using a different lot, and for instance, you just have this very unfortunate event where you do get bilateral endophthalmitis, I think that does become, that can become an issue.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's something I need to definitely check. I'll get back to you guys on that, actually. I have to double check and see. what the policy is here about that. I just don't know if that always happens, though. I need to, but again, I'm not, maybe I'm just not aware of it, but I will check and get back to you guys. We're going to finish with Will's favorite, which is PRP and injections and proliferative diabetic retinopathy. So this is entitled Panretinal Photocoagulation versus Ranibizumab for Proliferative Diabetic Retinopathy, Factors Associated with Vision and Edema Outcomes from Blue Journal by Bressler et al. Will, just want to talk a little bit about what this article showed and did, and then we'll end. Actually, I'll give you guys a chance to, Ajay and I already spoke about it on the podcast a little bit, but to talk a little bit about the five-year results. But let's talk about this article at hand. You want to tell us a little bit what they did?
Yeah, sure. And then chime in if I misquote something, because this is gets a little bit confusing at times for me. But basically this was a post hoc analysis of their 2-year results of Protocol S in the DRCR, and what they wanted to look at was how two specific outcomes, visual acuity and what they called central involving vision threatening DME, which I believe is vision worse than 2032. And center-involving DME, which I will subsequently refer to only as central DME, if it's okay with you guys. How those two things were affected by various risk factors and or various baseline characteristics in both groups. And so, for instance, in the ranibizumab group, the group that received only the anti-VEGF injections in the Protocol S, they looked at whether there were any baseline characteristics that affected the visual acuity change and the development of central DME at 2 years. And what they basically found in the ranibizumab group was that there no baseline characteristics had any strong association. About on average 3.7 letters were gained if there was no central DME at the beginning. They did note that in eyes that did not have significant DME at the beginning, these eyes did have somewhat less improvement if they'd had prior DME treatment, if I'm saying that correctly. So if they'd had previous injections for DME, they didn't do quite as well as the group that was naive to the anti-VEGF injections. And overall, 10% of patients got central DME when they were treated with ranibizumab. The panretinal photocoagulation group is a little bit more complex. The PRP group, basically, their visual acuity results were worse when the patient had baseline high mean arterial pressure, high A1C, or a worse grade of proliferative diabetic retinopathy. So basically worse PDR, worse A1C, and worse blood pressure, did worse with visual acuity. And when they looked at the group that did not have DME at the beginning, so basically patients with PDR getting laser who don't have central DME, or this group, also did worse vision-wise if they had high A1C, high diabetic retinopathy grade, and a large number of PRP spots put in. And then overall, about 27% of eyes developed DME in the group that got laser. And in an additional subgroup analysis that did looked at groups that did not receive any ranibizumab in the initial treatment with this study, because the PRP group could receive anti-VEGF in certain circumstances based on their algorithm. But they looked at the eyes that only had laser and nothing else. And these eyes got DME in about 37% of eyes. So their conclusion basically is that whereas the ranibizumab group doesn't really seem to have different outcomes based on the baseline characteristics of the disease, they seem to be relatively consistent, the PRP group does tend to do a little bit worse with poorly controlled diabetes, more aggressive diabetic retinopathy, and high blood pressure. And of course, this is a post hoc analysis they'd emphasize, which is so a lot of these things weren't powered to answer these questions.
Right. No, you know, not if you really look at that conclusion, I don't find it super surprising. I think that it makes sense that in the injection group, because everyone's sort of either gaining vision or maintaining, you're kind of washing out differences based on baseline characteristics. It does make sense that without that washout effect, people who are worse diabetics or worse retinopathy would have worse outcomes. But it just because something makes sense doesn't mean it'll be true when you do the analysis, and they went through the analysis and found it was true. Dan, your thoughts? Anything to add on top of what Will said?
I don't think so. I think again, it's a nice study. It's a post hoc analysis. I don't think it's telling us anything surprising that we wouldn't have already thought about these two different treatments. I would like to bring up a kind of related issue in terms of, you know, treatment for PRP, right? So we've talked about laser, we've talked about PRP, we've talked about ranibizumab. You know, since we can be a little bit radical, I like to propose something that I actually I believe and needs to be kind of further studied is actually that I think actually proliferative diabetic retinopathy, the first line therapy should actually be early vitrectomy with endolaser. And so be interesting to discuss this for you. So I think the idea behind this is this like false. Yeah. Is so for
I'm super excited right now, by the way. This is
dude,
awesome.
The podcast okay. Just went to a whole new level of this
all right.
Is great.
Yeah. So you heard it here. So, you know, you probably all have these patients with type 1 diabetes that get PDR. And then what happens is that, you know, really where people lose vision is when they start to develop the TRDs, the fibrovascular membranes. And the question is, you know, why does that happen? Well, it's because there's the vitreous as a scaffold. So, you know, the thought is if you remove that scaffold very early, you prevent that fibrovascular proliferation that really results in these, you know, really horrible blindness that occurs in PDR. So, you know, if you do that early, you mitigate that, you know, extremely blinding disease that happens. The second issue is actually something that I was discussing with my fellowship preceptor, Jay Stewart, is that sometimes with PRP, you can get these like very strong fibrovascular inflammatory reactions that can actually cause fibrovascular proliferation, and it seems that endo laser is actually a less inflammatory laser modality, and this is maybe based on some anecdotal cases, but by using endo laser, that actually might, you know, be a little bit more kinder and gentler to the eye. So I think based on those couple of things, like in terms of like if we want to prevent like blindness from diabetic retinopathy, if we get rid of the scaffold, we reduce the chance of things proliferating. You know, I think to do a vitrectomy in an early PDR patient is actually, you know, not that difficult. The vitreous might be a little bit hard, but it's actually fairly straightforward. And I think, you know, we've all noticed like the type 1 diabetics, like if we're doing TRDs, what I've noticed with the type 1 diabetics is that they generally do better because you can actually dissect the planes between like the vitreous and the retina versus I think with the type 2 or older ones, like it's all mushed together and you just can't separate those two tissues. And so I'm a firm believer, especially in type 1 diabetics, like to do early vitrectomy. And I think this, I've talked to people about trying to do this study. I think Reese Landers at North Carolina was actually doing a study for early vitrectomy for DME. And his thought is that, I think that's another benefit, is that you're relieving any kind of tractional component that might be related to DME, which might not be able to result with anti-VEGF. And another thing I saw was that recently, Bill Smitty, I think, presented something at the ASRS about cost effectiveness of vitrectomy versus like PRP. And I think it was like equivalent or better. And I think that's another issue from a cost effective standpoint. You can imagine this one surgery, which probably is actually, you know, you're compensated about as much as a PRP, is extremely cost effective for preventing like the long-term visual decline of diabetic retinopathy. So I would argue that vitrectomy is the most cost-effective benefit. And, you know, if in young patients you worry about cataracts, so I think we've known from studies where they've done like photorectomies, like if you just take a little bit of less of the kind of anterior vitreous, you can kind of slow that down. But I think in terms of long-term visual benefit, I really believe this, and I think it would be great if say the DRCR or someone would do this type of trial. I know it's a little bit heretic in some fields. But I think also this type of thing, you know, I think it needs to be, and I think not to throw in something else, but I think the, you know, the phase two studies of the latter with the Genentech port, I think that really can be, if that actually really works out well, that can be a game changer in terms of using ranibizumab for long-term PDR because, you know, I think what that's lacking is that kind of sustained release. Like you don't have to worry so much about compliance in this issue. So I'll get off my soapbox right now and love to hear you guys' comments.
Will, I got some things to say, but I'll leave the floor open to you as my honored guest.
First of all, Dan Chow is podcast gold, I got to say, man. you, probably listeners will just kind of stop listening right now. That was awesome. I agree. agree. I think I agree with just about everything Dan said. I'm not sure I'm quite as comfortable. I guess the question here is where do we, how far do we go with it right now with it? And I think you're correct about the physiology of it. And I have to say that over the last 3 or 4 years, I have gotten a lot more aggressive about going in early with vitrectomy in this situation. And specifically, I also just to comment, I think peeling ILM is very helpful broadly in these patients to help with reducing the DME and the, you know, and the membrane proliferation afterwards. But I get, you know, the question is do you do, are we going to be doing this on early PDR or in people who are pretty well controlled? Is this only for people who have high A1C who are, have an extensive PDR plus DME perhaps? And I think that, like Dan was saying, I think that's why we need to start getting a little more data out there and start looking at this comparatively. But I think you're correct that physiologically it is probably the better solution to do that early. And I agree these are very easy cases when you do them early.
So I'm going to start preface by saying I don't disagree and actually with anything that either of you guys said fundamentally, but because this is a fair and balanced podcast filled with fair and balanced information, I'm going to offer arguments for the other side. So the first argument is, which may be rendered moot by a long-acting therapy such as a port delivery system, is that the vitrectomy is going to reduce the, and we've talked about the data for this in the past, but it reduces the duration, the durability of your drugs that you may need in the future. So if they have DME and you need to treat it, maybe your durability is not as good. The second is that I do think that what Will brought up about which patients to select this for is interesting because protocol S did show that some PDR patients can be treated with injection alone. And if you have a long-acting delivery system, you know, that's obviously less invasive than going in and doing surgery, maybe if a patient doesn't need a vitrectomy, maybe their PDR is mild enough, their control is good enough, they wouldn't ever, they're fine with pharmacologic treatment alone versus an actual surgery or laser. The third is about this argument of the inflammatory nature of endolaser. I do think that while that data is true, I do think if you go in and do a full, complete PRP in one session with endolaser in a patient, it can be inflammatory. And actually, in a lot of those patients, I'll give them either subtenons or intravitreal steroid because I have had a couple of patients where I've had to do that in the setting of, for example, neovascular glaucoma, and they're putting in a tube and they want endolaser or a similar scenario. And obviously, there's other confounders with other surgeries there where they may end up with significant inflammation afterward. And we've heard of cases or seen cases even in the clinic. If you do a full PRP, you can get inflammation with choroidal detachments or exudative detachment of the retina. So inflammation is a consideration. I think psychology is super important, is that I think one of my attendings in fellowship really explained this well, was that for some of these patients, this is more for the type 2 diabetics than the type 1, if you just take them to surgery, there's almost the expectation of instant gratification. This is going to solve all of their ills and cure all their problems. And you know that's not necessarily going to be true from a vision perspective sometimes. There's other reasons their vision can be poor, such as macular ischemia, or just edema that isn't as responsive to therapy afterward. And they may look back, and patients tend to view surgery in a negative light much more than any other treatment when things don't come out good from an outcomes perspective. So they're going to be like, you know, this surgeon rushed me to surgery, and, you know, I just met them, and they want to do surgery and do all this. You know, even if what you were doing was probably the right thing if you did this study, there's still a psychology aspect of it where patients don't want surgery sometimes. And the final thing, though, and this is not disagreeing, but I'm like you guys, I've gotten earlier than I used to. I think the scenarios where I'll go in earlier is if I think the patient needs a full PRP, but they're not able to get that for either tolerance issues, media issues because of VH that won't clear, or a cataract issue. Sometimes I'll refer them for cataract surgery. Sometimes I'll have them do the cataract and go in and just, if the looks like there's good planes, do the vitrectomy and put the endolaser in at the same time so that everything is kind of nipped in the bud. Because I think we've all been in the frustrating scenario of very poor diabetic, poorly controlled diabetic with PDR with repeated episodes of bleeding, events, and really trying to, you're chasing the, I'm going to mess up the phrase, but you're kind of chasing, you're never ahead of the game, you're always behind, and you're always playing catch up with your laser, and you're never quite getting enough in. So I do think in certain scenarios it can be really good, and I agree with Will, I think peeling the ILM broadly in patients with DME who aren't responsive to anti-VEGF has been shown potentially be helpful, anecdotally be helpful, both in series and based on what people have presented. So I don't think there's a lot wrong with what you're saying, Dan. You definitely increased the marketability of this episode of the podcast. but I just would say those are the things that people are going to bring up as potential issues in that argument, besides the other risks of surgery.
Can I make a comment also kind of in support of Dan here really briefly? And again, this is, I feel masochistic. We're again bringing up a Wills thing, but Wills is doing some really good work right now on non-compliance, right? And how these non-compliant diabetics, how frequent it is and how they do poorly with all treatment, but especially anti-VEGF treatment in clinic, if they have their treatment interrupted and come back a year later. And, perhaps we need to change our mentality on this a little bit and start treating this more like glaucoma, where a patient shows non-compliance with glaucoma drops. They go to a glaucoma surgery, which is a more definitive procedure. You know, it has a little bit of added risk to it and won't make them better. It just basically stabilizes a patient. Perhaps non-compliance or high risk of non-compliance is considered a reason to consider surgery. So,
yeah. So Jay, just some final comments. I completely agree with all of your counterpoints. I think those are all very reasonable, and I guess I intentionally decided to be a little bit more controversial and aggressive just to kind of make the points. But I agree with you. I'm not, at this point, I'm not taking every patient that has diabetes to the vitrectomy to surgery. But I think it's a interesting. I firmly believe that this is probably the case, and I think what this really argues for is additional study of this. Like, for instance, the DRS study where they compared vitrectomy to laser, which is in our BCSE books, it's kind of taught as gospel that they're the same. We know that the vitrectomy instruments are like dramatically different. And so I think if we were to repeat that study, kind of do a reboot, as we're doing all these other reboots for these like Marvel superhero movies, a reboot of the DRS study, I think that would be very valuable. And then perhaps, I think it's an incremental thing. But I think it's worthy of further study. And I personally believe, I think, what we're all doing is we're going in a little bit earlier because we think that there is benefit to that. One other point just about the port, I think the port is very exciting in terms of this idea of long lasting sustained delivery. I would say one thing to caution about that is in terms of, we still want to understand the long-term effects in terms of risks for endophthalmitis. This port actually is as we're talking about, a phalange into the sclera. So the sclera is not closed like it is in the Retisert or other types of devices. And so we don't really know long-term follow-up in terms of the risk of endophthalmitis. Like, is the risk as much as, say, a barbell tube, which is a kind of very similar permanent implant, or is it less than that? Because if we're thinking about that, then I think people would be concerned, I'm putting anything that's like a ticking time bomb for endophthalmitis. And whereas, potentially I could just have a surgery, which can help, or I can get these injections where I don't have that risk for infection. I think that needs to be borne out through further testing. But I think these are all kind of issues with these, the surgical implants that for sustained drug delivery. I think really evaluating the risk of endophthalmitis, because otherwise we then do turn some of these surgeries into, I think these risks.
I like how you circled back around to the flange.
It Dan is just, he's all about that full circle.
Yeah.
Well, I don't remember when we talked about that. That might have been me and Will and I. I think it was Will and I earlier in the same episode we talked about the IOLs. It's like deja vu. I think we talked about the port delivery system maybe. And we talked about that potential risk. And Dan, the answer is we don't know, right? So we know that with barbells.
Yeah, we don't know exactly.
Yeah, we know with barbells, that risk doesn't go down. You can get endophthalmitis 10 years later. We've all seen it. The latter study, in 10 or 15 years, I really, really hope we don't. I hope, we all hope that does not happen, that this is different. But we really hope that you don't end up with patients with long endophthalmitis at a very late period after implantation. But we'll just have to wait and see. Well, Dan Chow, Will Park, we went way over time, but I think it was super informative, controversial, exciting, groundbreaking. So many fellows writing down this research idea. They're going to have competing diabetic vitrectomy studies. This is great.
That's right.
This is the new race for
we're trying
one.
To introduce the LeVar Bell type of marketing approaches to your podcast, Jay, to increase your visibility.
Well, on our next episode, Dan Chow says that he could out-attract Steve Charles and Robert Mockimer with one hand tied behind his back. that's not real. No one print that. I don't want the aggregators to pick that up. But
no, Jay said that. I didn't pay him to say that. And I no comment.
All right. Well, Dan, thanks so much for waking up early on your side of the country, and I'll talk to you both soon.
Thanks.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINA podcast.com. All 121 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page. You'll find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both on things we can do better, things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Drs. Chow and Dr. Park for joining me. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Menacasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Finally, thank you listeners for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.